From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, the pressure is on for the broadcast TV networks. By next week, they must decide which shows are back and which ones are toast. Then the documentary A Suitable Girl takes a look at arranged marriage in modern-day India, and it tries to dispel some of our Western misconceptions along the way.
We really went into this thinking we're going to be capturing sort of the last of this dying institution, in a sense. And that was not what we found. By and large, young people still believe in and ascribe to the system of arranged marriage.
And a composer hopes to capture the nation's sense of urgency. All that coming right up. This week is a pretty interesting time for the television business, with implications for people working in the industry and for regular TV watchers as well. Next week are the upfront presentations, where the broadcast TV networks sell their schedules to advertisers in New York. Network executives have some tough decisions to make ahead of their pitches to the buyers of some $20 billion in commercials. Network programmers are taking stock of the more than 70 new dramas and comedies that they've ordered, and to make room for some of them, they're determining which shows to bring back and which ones to cancel. Earlier today, I spoke with Hollywood Reporter TV critic Daniel Feinberg about where things stand now, and I asked him first, what's it like this time of year? Is it as crazy as it sounds?
It's the most wonderful time of the year. Yes, it is. It is absolute chaos is the easiest way to describe it. It is the time of the year when the networks are basically, you know, they're putting together sales presentations for billions and billions of dollars. So that's a pretty big deal that they're doing. But they're also knowing at all times that they're tempting the fates of millions of angry and potentially, I don't want to say violent, but definitely demonstrative television fans. And they're also, on a most basic level, they're trying to figure out brand identity. They're trying to figure out what the future looks like. And those are big issues.
So I think it's pretty easy. When you have a hit show, you know it's going to come back. Then there are the new shows that are kind of wobbling. And then there are the shows that haven't yet gotten on the air. So when you're thinking as a network executive, and you're trying to figure out what the balance of all those things are, what goes into the final decision-making process? Are you looking for shows that follow the identity of the network, that are offering something that other networks aren't? What is the mindset, and what sets some shows apart from others?
The first thing that's setting shows apart in this current business climate, honestly, is do they come from our in-house production arm? And I think that's becoming more and more and more the top and most important thing for networks. If you're NBC, is it coming from NBC Uni? If you're ABC, does it come from ABC Disney? The weird things that are happening at Fox because of the upcoming ABC Disney deal, that pretty much turns everything upside down for them. But I think that more and more and more, the decision-making process is starting with, do we own it? It's just about keeping the money in your pocket. And then it's going to things like, do we think it can be a hit? Or do we think it's like something that was a hit before? Are we chasing the new This Is Us? Are we chasing the next CBS-type procedural, that kind of thing? But I think ownership is, these days, it's really the most important thing. And that's a strange way to look at what is a quote-unquote art form on some level.
So I'm going to give you a spectrum, the network that has the most problems to solve and the network that has the fewest problems to solve. What would you say those two networks are?
Well, the network with the most problems to solve, without any question, is Fox. And it's not so much that it's problems they have to solve so much as uncertainties they need to figure out. Because the Fox network, as we currently know it, really may not exist in 6 months, in 12 months, in 18 months. They're basically planning for the future, but it's an entirely indeterminate future. So they're renewing a lot of stuff that in other years they never would have renewed. They're doing strange things like trying to figure out filler things like Lethal Weapon on Fox right now, which just fired its leading man. They're in the process of recasting, partially because it's a solid player for Fox. And so it's not a hit, but they want to have what they can have. So I would say without any question that Fox is the network that has the most question marks. I think that, as always, the stable networks, CBS is always stable. That's the good thing about being the number one most watched network on television, not the most watched in the demo, that's NBC. But CBS has a reliable sort of bedrock of shows that are watched by more people than any other network, and those shows will always be there, so you can always just plug in an NCIS, at least for the short term. You can always plug in a Big Bang Theory. You can always plug in a 60 Minutes. So they have the most stability. They're just figuring out how to work around those positions of stability. They could use some fresh blood, but who couldn't?
So we already know that some shows like Big Bang Theory and Grey's Anatomy are coming back. What else have we heard will be returning, and what veteran shows might still be on the bubble?
Well, I think at this point, I think we know sort of how things look, and even things that haven't been technically renewed, you can still make safe assumptions on. Like, NBC is going to probably renew all three of the shows with Chicago in the title. ABC has a lot of shows that they haven't renewed yet but are going to get renewed. But if you look at something like the CW, they've got basically one show on the bubble. Their bubble at this point is iZombie. That's it. And so that's pretty clean and easy to go, okay, well, at least I know what their big quote-unquote questions are. Another big question would be NBC's Timeless, which was a show that was canceled last year and then renewed within a week after a large amount of fan uproar, and also NBC looking at the numbers and figuring that there was value to having that show around for another 8 to 10 episodes. Well, is that going to be the case this year? Because it's definitely on the exact same bubble it was on last year. Do you only get one shot at sort of a fan campaign to save a show? You know, Jericho got a second season. It didn't get a third.
Let me ask you your personal fan campaign story. It is often the case that shows take a while to find an audience, and they sometimes live or die in that second or third season. Is there a show that you feel is in jeopardy that you really hope a network gives one more season to see if audiences can find it?
A lot of the shows that I'm going to be rooting hardest for are probably not really in jeopardy. They're just sort of in limbo. So something like Speechless on ABC is a show that I think is a great show, and I think it's a show that definitely deserves a third season. I expect it will get one. But ABC also has Fresh Off the Boat, which is in limbo for another renewal, and I think it would be very foolish to not pick that show up, what with Constance Wu, its star, having Crazy Rich Asians coming out this summer, which everyone expects is going to be a big hit. It would be a real mistake for ABC to not keep Fresh Off the Boat, which is a really good, full-of-heart family comedy in the fold, just to see if they can get more exposure for it out of her additional exposure.
Daniel Feinberg is a TV critic for The Hollywood Reporter. Daniel, as always, a pleasure having you on the show.
Anytime, sir.
To most Americans, the idea of arranged marriage seems foreign, old-fashioned, and very patriarchal. After all, most modern and Western women believe that they should decide on their own whom they want to spend the rest of their lives with. That said, we still carry a lot of misconceptions about what arranged marriage means for cultures that still practice it today. The new documentary, A Suitable Girl, follows three young women in India, Ritu, Dipti, and Amrita, as they navigate the matchmaking process with the help of their families. But it also shows the struggles that these educated women have when trying to negotiate their personal career goals alongside the traditional pressures to marry a man whom they don't pick or even date before tying the knot.
I'm a movie freak. I'm a shopaholic. I love partying. I was the first person from my whole family to go into a working kind of culture. But then as soon as I completed my MBA, my parents were like, no, you're not working anymore. We are just finding a groom for you.
The film was co-directed by Smriti Mundra and produced and edited by Jennifer Teixeira. And the two women joined me recently to talk about their seven-year journey to make the film. To start, I asked Smriti what the title A Suitable Girl means in Indian culture.
Women are referred to as girls until they get married. So you could be 40 and you're still referred to as a girl until you get married. The idea of a suitable girl is something that you read in matrimonial ads that is sort of discussed, you know, amongst matchmakers and families that, oh, I want to find a suitable girl for my son or things like that. So, and for people who have sort of taken issue with the way that, you know, women are commodified and spoken about, you know, within South Asian culture, it's been a very triggering term. So, that's where the title came from.
Jennifer, when you are looking at this world and the way that women meet their husbands, the whole idea of arranged marriages, how do you set aside your own beliefs in what marriage and relationship should look like and what authority women should have in that choice, and not judge the people that you were looking at because they live by different rules and have a very different culture?
that was kind of the big question when I met Smriti and decided to join this journey with her. I believe there's so many misconceptions of this world and India in general and the idea of arranged marriages. It was really quite easy to start, as we got to know these women and what they were going through, to relate to what they were going through and relate to their journeys. I feel like women in America and face a lot of the same pressures when it comes to getting married and having children. And a lot of us women have a lot of strong influence from our family members as well. And I think that was the thing that, you know, we related, or I related most to. I mean, there was definitely familial pressures and cultural pressures in my own family that I was like, oh, this isn't that much different.
Smriti, what about you? What about the misconceptions? Did you have some of your own? Do you think there are broader misconceptions that most Americans have who may be unfamiliar with the Indian culture?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I had a feeling, because I was raised in the U.S., so I'm from, you know, the Indian culture. I've spent time in India, but, you know, I come from a relatively progressive family, and I was, you know, raised here, you know, with Western values, so to speak. And my feeling was, okay, we're going to go to India, and we actually start talking to young women. They're going to be like, no way, no more arranged marriage. This institution is going, you know, out, you know, as women are becoming more financially independent and getting, you know, opportunities to work outside of the home and, you know, getting higher education. There's no way this is going to last. And so we really went into this thinking we're going to be capturing sort of the last of this institution, this sort of dying institution in a sense. And that was not what we found. We found that by and large, young people still believe in and ascribe to the system of arranged marriage. And what it is, I mean, it's such a sort of ominous thing to say the system or institution of arranged marriage. But all it really is just involving your family in the decision making of finding a spouse. And the value set that it speaks to is just slightly different than what we look for in the West, where it's more sort of based on family and community and less on individual wants and needs. I think what I found is that young people still want their families involved. They still want to sort of fit within that community structure, but they want to make some space for their own wants and needs.
Right. I want to ask you about one scene where a prospective husband is visiting a potential wife, yeah, and the woman's father says this of her. Other than her job or some work function, she doesn't really go anywhere. After school, she comes right back home. She doesn't have many friends either. This is his sales pitch to this guy, that this is the kind of woman that he has raised. What is it like to witness that, and how representative of the culture do you think that conversation is?
You know, in regards to what Deepthi's dad said, you know, about her, he was speaking to this idea, this concept of homeliness. And that has a different meaning in India than, you know, it does here. Over here, it's sort of referencing people's looks. But in India, that means that her focus is on the home. Her attention is on the home. She wants to be married. She wants to have children. And in some ways, it's almost a response to this sort of mounting discomfort that young women, you know, have demonstrated en masse, like, you know, these patriarchal ideas. So he's sort of reassuring that, no, don't worry. She's not that type of girl. She really wants to be married. She wants to focus on her family and have children and do those things. Her father was struggling immensely with the idea of letting her go because that's his only child. And, you know, they are so close. So when he was presenting her in that way to a prospective groom, he was speaking about her as a treasure in the terms that the groom would appreciate.
We're talking with Smriti Mundra and Jennifer Teixeira. Their new film is called A Suitable Girl. Jennifer, how did you go about figuring out who you wanted to follow, and how did you gain their trust so that you could watch these very intimate moments in their lives?
I had a prior relationship with Seema. She was my matchmaker, actually, before all of this film stuff started. And so I had a prior relationship with her. And so there was like sort of an inherent sort of trust. She's part of my community and very known to my family. And so we sort of stepped into each scenario, you know, and then sort of started gaining trust and kind of getting more access and more access. But with Seema and Ritu, it was really like my relationship with Seema. And Seema was very eager to sort of have us document her business and her, you know, lifestyle and everything. And then, but we kind of knew the real story was with her and her daughter. So we really kind of worked to try to get access. And, you know, her daughter Ritu was very reluctant initially, you know, to film with us and open herself up to us. But by the end of it, it was remarkable. She was either forgot we were there, or she was able to kind of communicate things through us that she couldn't with other members of her family. And the same thing happened with the other girls. You know, they were each, we kind of became this intermediary, I think, you know, between like these girls and their families, because they could talk to us about things that they couldn't talk to their families about. And, you know, the more kind of comfortable they got, the more present we were, the more they opened up.
You said something. You're a former client of the matchmaker. What does that mean?
Okay, so...
You can't close that door.
So I am, in case you can't tell, an Indian-American woman.
And I think you're blushing a tiny bit, so it's radio, but keep going.
This whole process started from a very personal place. Sarita and I were Indian women. We were kind of in our late 20s, 30s, you know, when we were in film school, and the pressure was mounting for both of us to get married. My last year of graduate school, I had, you know, broken up with a boyfriend who was sort of the suitable boy, you know, kind of great on paper, and, you know, who I thought I was going to marry. And after that, I think I was 28 when that relationship ended. And I didn't realize how much of that sort of you have to get married before you're 30 and all of that stuff I had internalized, because I went into a panic. You know, I was like, I'm 28, I'm not married. All of the stuff that I'd heard through my entire life just came bearing down on me. I told my mom within 48 hours she was in New York City in my apartment. She had Shaadi.com, the Indian matrimonial site, open. We were making my profile, and she said, don't worry. She's like, I'm going to handle this. And she's like, I'm going to cast a wide net, full APB. I had a matrimonial ad in the newspaper. I was meeting with matchmakers. I was doing the online matrimonial website stuff. I was meeting, you know, young men in New York, wherever I was, in London, in Bombay, when I was home in California. I mean, I went on 100 of these sort of awkward coffee dates, you know, and that's sort of where my kind of curiosity to really explore this in a documentary came from, because actually the experience, I was torn, because on one hand, I met a lot of really interesting people. It wasn't that I did not meet my husband that way, but I did meet a lot
of
people.
So it didn't work out.
It didn't quite work out
for
me.
Your mom struck out.
But I will admit that it was my own bias against this system that was the reason it didn't work out for me in that way.
Let me ask you both this. When you watch the film The Big Sick, what did you think about the way that that movie depicted arranged marriages?
I love that film, and it was their story. And, you know, I think I told a version of my story in this film, and I think they did the same. But I did have an issue with the way they depicted arranged marriages, and particularly South Asian women in that film. It was a very one-dimensional sort of portrayal. And, you know, I've said this also about, you know, shows like Master of None and other films like Meet the Patels, where when these stories are told from the male perspective, you get a very one-dimensional view of South Asian women, that we also, that's all we want is to get married, you know? And to some degree, a lot of us have internalized, you know, that messaging from when we were younger, but the truth is much more complex. And that's what we try to really portray in our film, is that, you know, we are also sort of bound by culture and tradition. You know, we are also trying to do the best we can, you know, to be good daughters to our parents and not, you know, sort of fall off of, you know, the ledge of society. So to see South Asian women and the idea of arranged marriage presented in such a harsh light was disappointing to me. And I felt it was, you know, it was comedic, but, you know, I think we made this film because we were tired of being the butt of the joke.
Smriti Mundra is the director and producer of A Suitable Girl. Jennifer Teixeira is the producer and editor of the film. Jennifer and Smriti, thanks so much for coming in.
Oh, thank you
so much. Thank you.
A Suitable Girl is available now on Amazon Prime and iTunes. When composer Ellen Reed was commissioned to write a new piece for the Los Angeles Master Chorale, she chose to write about America. But that was 2 years ago, and America felt like a different place. The piece called Dreams of the New World is about to have its world premiere, and Reed says it went from feeling poetic to feeling urgent. The Frame contributor Tim Grieving has our story.
The piece has remained intact, but what's changed is the landscape that the piece is reflected against.
Ellen Reed was on a research road trip for Dreams of the New World, driving between Memphis, Tennessee, where her family's from, Houston, Texas, and her current home in L.A. during the 2016 election campaign and its aftermath.
And it's been just really interesting and important to have the piece to be able to talk about what's happening personally for me, that this piece has given me a window to talk about the chaos that I feel like is surrounding us right now. But we had these questions about this reoccurring excitement and then bust of the American dream before 2016. The genesis of this piece came from a question about what is the mentality behind the American frontier, and looking at places that thought of themselves as part of the West at some point in history. And I'm obsessed with Memphis. My dad's side of the family is from there for many, many generations. And it seemed like we couldn't tell a story about America without looking at oil and the energy industry in Houston. And with LA being at the westernmost point of the continent, it felt like the perfect spot to complete our question about what is this mentality behind the frontier.
Reed composes everything from electronic pop to opera. In 2015, she was one of the composers featured in Hopscotch, the roving opera on wheels created by the LA-based experimental opera company, The Industry. That's when she met Sarah Labrie, who wrote the libretto for Dreams of the New World.
The genesis of this piece was also moments in American history when it felt like we were all on the verge of something. This moment when it seemed like everything was about to change and what happened after that moment. So in Memphis, we're looking at the Reconstruction era when there's this period where Black people really were able to thrive in Tennessee, create their own businesses. Robert Church had a real estate empire. And it seemed like we were on the brink of this new moment. And then, of course, all of that was taken away. All of that was destroyed. You know, so we see the sort of celebration of American promise and potential and what's possible, and then sort of the dark side, what's on the other side of that, and what we kind of continuously ignore when we think about the concept of something like the American dream.
Labrie, Reed, and researcher Sadie Randall interviewed local experts, professors, historians, and entrepreneurs in each of the three cities, and Labrie based her libretto on those conversations. And even though they were asking people about the past, Reed says it was impossible not to feel the weight of the present.
We interviewed people with wildly different political beliefs and beliefs about what these words mean. For example, freedom. You know, to a scholar in Memphis talking about the Reconstruction era, freedom means something really different than someone who's working in LA in the space industry looking toward Mars. I knew that the LA section would be very modern because it's modern, and I wanted something that feels expansive and with a synthesizer, and I wanted for choir to sound like the magic of space. I don't know if you heard these sounds that NASA released where they, I think they took these waves from planets and translated it into sonic waves. The Los Angeles I know doesn't involve a lot of people interested in aerospace. And so I got to know a different aspect of the city that is really thriving and that's attracting a lot of people from all over the country and the world. And we got to talk to some incredible scientists from NASA and JPL and talk to some people who are working in the tech sector and to hear the different ways that they're talking about how they see the future was really enlightening for me. But it seemed like the right thing for the project because, in my mind, you get to the end of the frontier and it just keeps going.
With the shadow of the last election and the current political climate hanging over Dreams of the New World, I asked Reed if she would describe her piece as optimistic or dire.
I would describe it as poetic, where I hope that it raises questions for people. I have my personal opinions, but I'm hoping that the piece, as a piece of art, will spark conversations, and depending on what you believe in, it'll mean something really different. I think through the nature that it's a choir piece, it'll be more accessible than something that is more abstract.
For The Frame, I'm Tim Grieving.
Ellen Reed's Dreams of the New World has its world premiere this Sunday at Walt Disney Concert Hall. It will be performed by the Los Angeles Master Chorale with the Wild Up Ensemble. And that's The Frame for today. I'm John Horn. Remember to follow us on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram. You will find us at The Frame. We'll see you back here tomorrow.